Welcome, everyone. My name is Kay King, and I'm the Vice President for External Relations here at CSIS, and I'm delighted to welcome all of you to this very special occasion, celebrating the publication of Bates Gill's new book, Rising Star, China's New Security Diplomacy. We are happy to have two very special guests here this evening in addition to Bates. First, we have Mike Green, who is a senior advisor and Japan chair here at CSIS, and he will be starting off this evening's presentation, followed by Neil King, who is a diplomatic correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and Neil will be followed by Bates, who will give us some sense of his views on his own book after his two colleagues have offered their commentary. So I invite you then, also after Bates has made his presentation, we'll open up the floor for some questions. And then I invite you after that to continue with the wine and cheese reception. And again, welcome and thank you all for coming. Mike.
Thank you. I love this book. I laughed. I cried. Mostly laughed. No. This is a really terrific and important book. I came to CSIS in January 2006 after 5 years on the NSC staff, and I was looking forward to coming here because Bates was here, and it's been an absolute delight because in a town where a lot of topics are not always rationally debated, and especially China. Bates really has established a voice of reason based on careful empirical work, careful consideration of different views, and this book really captures all that. I think it's an important book. My only real complaint, I'll say up front, is that Bates timed this very carefully. I teach a course on Asian security at Georgetown, and I've been struggling to find the right text to use for the China section of the course, and Bates carefully planned this so they came out the week after my lecture on China, which is unfortunate for my students because now they're all going to be assigned it before the end of the semester, and they thought they had done most of the reading. The rising star, China's New Security Diplomacy, gets into the details and looks at how China is developing a strategy commensurate with its rising power, but also its perennial problems. I have felt for some time that the United States, Japan, the EU, Australia, and others made a bet when we engaged China, encouraged China to join the WTO, that we could change China and change Chinese behavior through this engagement, through China's participation in the international economy, that we could change China's behavior faster than China would change the world. And when I was in the NSC for those 5 years, I asked myself frequently, so which one's happening faster? What's so terrific about this book is Bates gets into the details of how China's growing involvement in multilateral organizations, in international security, is in fact changing its behavior. And Bates very carefully and precisely details some of these important developments. As China, takes on more responsibilities in the six-party talks, in international nonproliferation, and in regional multilateral organizations like APEC. But at the same time, reading the book, you realize that China's weight is also changing these institutions, and that China, in fact, has increased its participation in these institutions for both reasons. Both to, in effect, for those who want to increase China's role as a responsible power in the Chinese system, to use this participation in multilateralism, to use engagement in the six-party talks to start changing the way China does business, socializing the leadership to these international obligations, and yet at the same time very deliberately joining and participating in these institutions and able to shape their regional environment, limit the ability of the U.S. or other powers to affect Chinese interests. And you can see in great detail in Bates' case studies how China's doing both at the same time. There are a lot of books coming out on China or articles that purport to know China's secret long-term strategy for whatever it is, domination. And I think Rising Star very carefully and precisely conveys, these are my words, I guess, not Bates, but conveys what is in effect a coping strategy by Beijing. As Bates outlines it, there are basically three elements or motivations. First is maintaining stability. Second is increasing China's influence. And the third is finding ways to counter or co-opt the influence of the U.S. or other powers that would affect China's interests. What's interesting in these case studies, and as you look at China, is how the first of these, the emphasis on stability. Why? Because as President Hu Jintao told President Bush in almost every summit he had, China's overwhelming interest is to tend to its domestic challenges. President Hu would outline for President Bush 22 million Chinese moving to the cities every year seeking employment, the huge disparities in income and wealth between the coasts and the provinces, the need that China has to establish intellectual property rights and various other challenges, and therefore peaceful development. President Hu's overarching strategic concept requires a stable external environment. And what you see in Rising Star chronicled is how China, in attempting to maintain that stable external environment, while at the same time increasing its influence by participating more in things like the six-party talks, has been trapped and has had to deal with international problems that it, frankly, would not have chosen to deal with, given all the domestic challenges. Classic example is the six-party talks. When Jim Kelly, I'll embarrass him by pointing it up, when Jim Kelly and Secretary Powell went to China in February 2002 to pitch the six-party talks, Jiang Zemin's position was that this DPRK nuclear problem is a U.S. DPRK issue. China is not associated with it. And Secretary Powell eventually convinced him that China should play a role. And I think China's initial instinct was to maintain stability, to keep the process going, but to not risk anything by putting pressure on North Korea, which might lead to instability or rash actions by North Korea. And there's been an evolution, and you can see it quite clearly in China's stand today, where Beijing has, I think, come to understand from dealing with the North Koreans, from staking its reputation on this process, that stability sometimes requires a little bit of risk-taking and a little bit of intervention and some pressure. And China is putting pressure on North Korea today through Security Council sanctions, through financial measures against Banco Delta Asia in ways that I don't think people fully expected 2 or 3 years ago. And so it's changing in some ways China's behavior. But ultimately, we don't know in the six-party process how far that goes. We don't know, for example, whether Beijing will revert to keeping the diplomatic process going for its own sake rather than keeping pressure on Beijing. And it also leads to some tough questions. You know, one of the debates that has happened in the administration that I think will come back is whether or not China should join the G8. You know, on the one hand, as Bates points out, China's participation in these multilateral organizations socializes the Chinese foreign ministry, raises expectations, puts pressure on them to play a positive role. But on the other hand, it allows China to game the system and to shape outcomes in ways that advantage China. Similarly, peacekeeping, one of the things Bates focuses on. China is doing more on peacekeeping. That's a good thing. That involves burden sharing. And you know, there's this hegemonic stability theory and the question of whether rising powers will help the hegemonic power maintain stability or not. Well, for China to help the U.S. maintain stability, you want China to do more peacekeeping. But at the same time, Beijing is using its position in peacekeeping in Haiti, for example, to put pressure on Haiti and Central American governments to switch relations away from Taiwan, and is gaming the system. So you have this real tough judgment call in each one of these cases where you want to engage China, get them more involved in the multilateral organizations, but it has some risk. And Rising Star chronicles some of these trade-offs and I think is very useful for policymakers in that way. Bates knows a lot about nonproliferation. In fact, we took a trip to China in 1999 on the State Department's dime to sort of challenge the Chinese on nonproliferation and arms control issues. And it's a very different and much more positive story today in terms of China's role in export controls and nonproliferation, and that's a good thing. On the other hand, how far does arms control go? How far is China willing to go on military transparency? My guess would be, Mr. Finkelstein would know well, but my guess would be not that far. Because if peaceful development is designed to encourage your neighbors, you're not dangerous. The last thing you want to do is be honest about how much you're developing medium-range ballistic missiles designed to incinerate Tokyo, or talk about your submarine development. So while you have a very good story in terms of nonproliferation and export control, you know, arms control, transparency, CBMs, that's going to be a very tough slog, I think. And it raises real tough questions about how much the civilian leadership will be able to exert control over the PLA when this information is not necessarily shared entirely with the foreign ministry or much of the civilian leadership in China. And I think that challenge comes out as well. Having read the book, came out at the end much smarter on the issue, I think. Not yet certain, and I don't think Bates was trying to answer this question, about which way this coping strategy will ultimately go, with a mix of engagement and being socialized to international norms and multilateral cooperation versus gaming the system for advantage in terms of relative gains over the U.S. and other powers. I don't think Bates intended to answer that, but he certainly pointed to what we should be watching to understand how that will go and where we can try to expand areas of cooperation with Beijing and send very clear signals where we don't see positive behavior. So for that, I thank Bates and encourage you all to read the book. A few of my students are here. You now know your extra homework assignment. Plus, unlike the other students, you got free wine and cheese. So thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to sit here with two people who I've frequently called upon in moments of desperation and need for instant wisdom, being in the profession where I have to borrow wisdom from others. Bates wanted me to announce that he is going to be releasing a Cliff Notes version of this book for members of Congress and an audio tape as well, right? 30-minute distilled audio tape.
Starring Tony Randall.
For Chuck Schumer and others that might need it. Once took a long trip through Asia when I was a much younger person, and so in that trip, which lasted about a year, I saw kind of a real Asia, and then I went repeatedly to China with Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of Commerce, USTR, who have I left out? Secretary of State, of course. A number of those trips, which I'm not just saying that that's not the real Asia or the real China, but it's much more the China that the U.S. sort of... or the vision of China that members of the U.S. government bring with them and see in a sort of fake close-up way, which is to say also the way that most journalists in Washington see China. And so to that extent, I'm a true China watcher in Washington. And watching China from the vantage of Washington, watching China from the vantage point of Washington is largely witnessing the spasms that seem to occur maybe at this rate about every 9 months or something like that. I first came to Washington from having been in Europe for 8 or 9 years in the 90s, just in time for the big spasm that was the PNTR vote. Of course, soon after that, that was the spy plane incident at Hainan Island and so on. And in a way, it seems to me that we're in a kind of lull. Maybe this comes out just in time for people to have a little bit of a moment to read and to be prepared for the next spasm. I went to a dinner a couple of weeks ago that was interesting that the longtime National Committee on United States-China Relations hosted for some members of Congress. It was an off-the-record dinner, so I won't get too into it. But it was the two featured guests were Henry Kissinger and Madeleine Albright. And it was an interesting session because they were all new members of Congress there to hear the views of China from two former secretaries of state, including one who obviously was big in U.S.-China relations at the early days. And ask questions. What was interesting to me was that very few of the questions got to the sort of the threat or sort of fear side of the debate, which often obviously comes out, the whole notion that China presents some sort of long-term threat to the United States. And so many more of the questions got to the whole question of sort of to what extent China is going to create growing imbalances that the U.S. is going to have to deal with, whether it be carbon emissions or use of oil or other kinds of, I guess, geopolitical imbalances like being much more active in Africa now or even in Latin America than would have been the case 3 or 4 years ago even. The thing that's extraordinary to me about China is I was trying to figure today whether there's been any similar relationship that the U.S. has ever had, and this in a sort of facile way. It seems that the only similar one might have been with Great Britain a long time ago, and that is where we've been so extraordinarily, or become so extraordinarily dependent, interdependent, with a country that at the same time presents a challenge or even a military threat to us in some ways. Certainly that was never the case with the Soviet Union in terms of any interdependence. And as Bates points out in here, our relationships with Germany and so on, various times when we've actually had a real military challenger, was also not similar, nor was the kind of economic challenge that Japan posed to us, particularly in the 80s when we were most cognizant of it, did it have a corollary on the military side. So it's interesting to me, and I saw use the judicious terms, engager hedgers versus China hawks, to be kind of the two basic camps in Washington, and concludes that neither of them are really right and that both of them have their demerits in terms of they either seeing China too simply as a threat or too simply by ignoring the things that might be challenging on the security side. I did have to laugh just as a footnote because I was in reading this. By the way, my one little thing that I found missing from the book was you get here and where you expect to see the beautiful picture of Bates Gill, you instead get a picture of a flag, which I thought was.
You hold it up a mirror.
I see. But he had a line in here that said,
take note.
Looking ahead, this was in the early part talking about the U.S. Approach towards China. It says, there are some signs that a more reasoned, judicious, and coherent set of understandings and policies are in the works for Washington's China policy, but it remains too early to predict their effectiveness and sustainability. And then it had a footnote, number 30, so I quickly went to that, being, of course, interested in what the signs of a more reasoned, judicious, and coherent set of understandings were, and found that they were all at CSIS. No. that it was Zelik's consultative sessions that he was having with the Chinese, which, of course, have now become a thing of the past, with Zelik having moved on. And I suppose in some nominal sense, they've been replaced by Secretary of Treasury Paulson. The only reason I really bring that up is that it's interesting that in our foreign policy establishment, it was certainly the case that Bob Zelik filled this very unusual niche that was very well timed and would have probably been good for all of us if it had lasted, because he brought both the national security sense of his previous incarnations in the previous Bush administration, et cetera, with the economic understanding that he has and that he certainly increased during his term at USTR. And it was like the perfect package in terms of approaching China, which neither a Paulson nor a Bob Gates or Rumsfeld would ever bring to the equation. And it's that kind of understanding that I hope and trust if people actually go through and read this, particularly the Cliff Note version for Congress and others, that this will really help fill that gap, because there's I think it's true to say that China's new security diplomacy is a lot more evolved and a lot more intelligent in its awareness of sort of its corollary on the American side than is the case going the other way. The U.S. obviously has a lot more learning to do about China than I think that China has to do about the United States. So here's hoping that Bates's book fills that gap. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Neil. Well, that's very kind of both of you. This just underscores for all of you who have a book event in the future is to make sure to serve wine to the to the discussants before one begins. Let me start by just thanking all of you very, very much for coming this afternoon, on this beautiful afternoon. I was telling my wife, Sarah, that if I were walking out of my office at 5 p.m. this afternoon to go to a book launch, I probably would have stayed outside. So I do thank you all for coming here. I also want to extend a special note of gratitude to our two commentators, great colleagues Mike Green and Neil King, for taking some time out this afternoon to speak about the book a little bit and even take time to look it over. I really do deeply appreciate that. This sort of endpoint, I guess you'd say, of a book launch obviously results from, at least in my case, from many, many, all too many years and time of work. but most importantly results from being able to look to work that's gone before and to stand on shoulders truly of giants and incredibly intelligent people who have looked at these issues so carefully and helped frame them in ways that one could build upon them. And, you know, there are so many of you in this room here today, and I want to extend my gratitude to all of you. I'm particularly grateful because I began this book when I worked at the Brookings Institution, so I do want to say thanks to Mike Armacost and Richard Haas and Jim Steinberg, and, of course, as well to the current my current boss, John Hamry, who is just a fantastic person to work with for creating the kinds of environment that allows people like me to pursue this kind of work. I've also been fortunate that a lot of people took a careful look at these pages well before they came out. People like Evan Medeiros and Taylor Fravel, Jim Steinberg, Dave Shambaugh, Yuan Jingdong, Ian Johnston, Mike Glosny, people like this, very, very, very helpful in their commentary. Also, six anonymous reviewers, so maybe one of you is in this room. Sorry it got published. I do appreciate those excellent comments. I should also underscore that, as everyone in this room who works in the think tank knows, all the real work gets done by those younger people who do the enormous amount of research assistance, and I want to thank them. Many of them are here as well. James Riley, Jennifer Zhang, Drew Thompson, Matt Orsman is here, Jennifer Feltner, Melissa Murphy's here, Huang Jinhao is here, Eve Carey is here. I thank you all very, very much. And as I say in the book, having worked with you so closely, I am extremely confident that the future of China watching is in extremely, extremely good hands. And then finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't thank Savina Rupani and Virginia Roselle, who worked closely with me for many, many years, who were so supportive. One more person can't go unmentioned, and that's Sarah Palmer, my wife. Unfortunately, she has caught this terrible flu cold thing that's going around in the past several weeks, and just at the last minute, after 7 long years of this book, couldn't show up not to tonight's event. Coincidence? I don't know. No. Anyway, she's obviously such an important person in support of this of a completion of a project like this. Let me be very brief and give maybe the Cliff's Notes of this book for those of you who aren't going to have time to actually read it. It is an attempt to try and describe and go into pretty painful detail the developments in Chinese security policy over the past 7 to 10 years, and to first, in the first chapter, sort of lay out what I see to be the principal motivations behind this rather remarkable turnaround in a lot of approaches of China towards matters of international security. Mike laid them out, being an overriding concern with domestic development and so therefore seeking to create a more peaceful and stable environment externally. Secondly, a recognition of the so-called security dilemma, so that other countries wouldn't bandwagon and seek to contain China, but would rather be reassured, quote-unquote, by a so-called peaceful development of China's rise. And then lastly, to do all of this in a way that doesn't directly confront the United States, recognizing that to do so would upset the apple cart of all the other major goals that they have. And that this gets well described in a lot of authoritative Chinese tifa of various kinds, like peaceful rise, peaceful development, responsible great power, all these sorts of phraseologies, which are obviously much more detailed and nuanced than I'm able to describe here, but I try to lay out in a relatively short fashion at the beginning where all of this new security diplomacy is coming from. The core chapters of the book try to lay out then in sort of case study fashion what it is we're really talking about when we discuss the new security diplomacy. And I looked at three major issue areas, one being China's approach to regional security mechanisms, secondly, China's approach to nonproliferation and arms control, and third, China's approach to sovereignty and intervention. In each of those cases, I think the general argument can be made that just over the past 7 to 8 years, we've seen some remarkable changes, and in some cases even 180-degree changes, in the way that China's prepared to talk about these questions and the way it's prepared to do things that, in my view, increasingly converge with international expectations, regional norms, and even U.S. interests. Now, each of those different baskets, there are varying degrees of this convergence. I think the best case can probably be made on the issue of arms control and nonproliferation. A slightly less good case can be made, but still strong, I think, on the issue of China's approach to regional security mechanisms. And that's a pretty big basket that includes everything from approaches to alliances, to multilateral security organizations, to bilateral mil-mil contacts. It's a pretty largely defined approach to mechanisms there. And probably the weakest case, but still an interesting case, I think, can be made on this question of China's approach to questions of sovereignty and intervention, sensitive issues where China still holds very strong traditional views, but where there are some interesting dynamics and changes that we should be paying closer attention to. So I go into pretty painful and excruciating detail there. Your students are going to love me for that, I hope, Mike. And in those three sort of big case study areas. The concluding chapters of the book are then intended to raise the question, so what? What does this mean primarily for the United States, but also for the international community more broadly? And in the first of those concluding chapters, I try to lay out what I see to be the principal challenges. Because as Mike suggests, while this approach is generally convergent, I think, with international norms, regional expectations, and U.S. interests, nevertheless, China's clearly positioning itself in some ways to achieve more narrowly defined self-interested goals. So we shouldn't simply believe that we can all sing kumbaya and go home. Clearly, China's new security diplomacy is raising new challenges for us, for example, with regard to the future of China-Taiwan-U.S. relations, the future of China-Japan-U.S. relations. It's raising challenges for us in assuring that we see outcomes on the Korean Peninsula that we in the United States would like to see. I think it raises new questions for us in terms of our alliance relationships in the region, China forging new partnerships with key friends and allies, Australia, even in Europe and in places like South Korea. Mike's already raised the point that we do have concerns still over questions of nonproliferation and arms control, for example, related to military transparency, and the ASAT test is just the most recent, perhaps most egregious recent example of where our concerns lie there. We continue to have real differences over how we're going to deal with threatening or objectionable regimes in the world, such as in Sudan or in Burma. And also, we continue to have concerns over whether we can expect continued strong Chinese support in the anti-terrorism effort worldwide. So the point of that chapter is to make the argument that, yes, broadly speaking, China's new security diplomacy is one that we should welcome, but that also positions China in a way that makes our attempts to deal with some of these questions of American interest more difficult. In the principal concluding chapter, however, I do try to lay out in detail where there are still some unmet opportunities, where there are developments associated with the Chinese new security diplomacy that we've probably not given ample attention to, and where if we redouble our efforts to engage China in some of these issues, we can, I think, expect an even deeper, more long-term and sustainable commitment on China's part to issues that are resonant with the American longer-term interest. And here I break it again up into the three major baskets of regional security, arms control and nonproliferation, and questions of sovereignty and intervention. I make such recommendations as the need to maintain and expand our military-to-military relationship with China, the need to deepen our interaction with China in regional security mechanisms, the need for us to strengthen our coordination with friends and allies with regard to China, and how we will work or seek to work in concert with regard to China's rise, and of course the need to even further underscore the need for us to realize a long-term non-military resolution to differences across the Taiwan Strait. On the question of arms control and non-proliferation, we need to intensify our pressure on China in terms of certain persistent persistent Chinese proliferation cases. I'm afraid we've become a little bit pro forma in our every six-month sanctioning regime that we level against China. We ought to do what we can to bolster China's domestic monitoring and export control capacities. I devote a good bit of time in the book to the issue that we helped launch, I think, in late 99, early 2000, when we went over to China, and that is to establish a more regularized and sustainable framework for our two countries to discuss questions of nuclear weapons, modernization, and the offense-defense balance, which is emerging between the United States and China. And maybe also importantly, to work with China in recognizing and expanding those areas where we've seen real success in China's overall non-proliferation record. And then finally, on the sets of issues related to sovereignty and intervention, recommend that we intensify our discussions with China on issues of objectionable and threatening regimes. I think there's serious room there to bring about or expand the common ground, the common approaches that we have, as long as we're able to frame it in a way that China understands that that its interests surely lie in addressing the potential trans-border effects of these kinds of regimes that can begin to impact on Chinese security. The need to work with China to define and come to common terms in understanding new transnational threats that are emerging on the international scene. I do believe China is increasingly open to recognizing that there is such a thing as threats that go beyond borders, transnational, and that they need to be addressed in ways that don't fall back, that do not fall back on the sort of age-old non-interference in internal affairs principles that China often seeks to reach for. And, of course, to encourage Chinese support and participation in United Nations peacekeeping activities and nation-building operations as well. None of these are particularly new ideas. I think the book argues that they are probably still, though, not entirely fully realized by Washington as areas where we can, in fact, achieve even deeper commitments from China and greater cooperation. At the end of the day, I conclude by saying that China is simply too big, obviously, to ignore. Our relationship is increasingly interdependent in ways that probably most Americans don't realize, and that any realist strategy, with a capital R, has to acknowledge the necessity to engage with China and to seek the best possible way forward through the expansion of our common ground. I know that's not easy. It's probably not even a popular way of thinking in many quarters here in Washington, D.C., but I am firmly of the belief that it is definitely in the U.S. interest over the long term to lean in that direction and to do what we can to expand our relationship with China on these areas of opportunity that are still unmet. So with that, I'll conclude, and I want to once again thank all of you very much for coming. Looking very much forward to your comments, questions, and concerns. Thanks again. I suppose I'll just serve as moderator, if that's all right. That way I won't recognize people with hard questions. No, John, not you. I'm sorry. No, please.
Well, after the presentations, I'm very eager to read the book. I'd like something a little bit more than the Cliff Notes version, but I do hope I see it's got not very thick, but I do hope it has big letters so it's easy to read and it can go through quickly.
No, it's very small.
One question that really comes up here. I agree completely with you that there's significant changes in all three baskets over the last 7 to 9 years. Do you address, and if so, what is it? How did the Chinese come about changing their approach to, just call it broadly, international relations to come about here? Was it something that Jiang Zemin led, or was there a process that reached consensus, a deliberate consensus within the party leadership, or is it something that is there continuity in this process between Jiang Zemin and the transition to Hu Jintao and his leadership? But what type of internal dynamics went through to sort of a sea change in the approach to foreign policy?
Thanks, John. And I'd be very interested in having our commentators comment as well and get their observations on the table. The book tries to make the argument that while the most dramatic shifts have been seen pretty much since 1999, and here I stand on the shoulders of people like Dave Finkelstein and the debate of that summer, 1999, in developing the so-called new security concept, nevertheless, you can also trace its roots much farther back, even to Deng Xiaoping's grand vision of the early 1980s. It's just that I don't think it cohered very well into these sort of TIFA or authoritative statements, nor did it cohere in a way that you began to see on the ground change like we've seen now in just the past 7 to 9 years. So I think it does have deep roots, in fact, to this grand vision that it just makes greater strategic sense for China not to start stirring trouble here and there, and that they need to deal with their domestic challenges first and foremost. And as they've accelerated in their rise, they've also come to the recognition of the security dilemma and the need to reassure the neighbors and not confront the Americans. I think much of that realization and the sort of conceptualization of that in a more coherent and then in a more coherent way, first of all as ideas and then in its implementation on the ground, I think largely unfolded under Jiang Zemin's watch. The question I think you're asking is whether or not this new leadership is as beholden to this or interested in trying to pursue it. I think the answer to that is yes. And while maybe it's not being put forward in the same sort of sharp and crisp language in some respects, it strikes me that they have little other strategic option but to do so. And so I see this as a not simply a tactical or devious approach to how they want to orchestrate international relationships, but rather one that has real sustainability and longer-term shelf life. I don't know if Mike or Neil have been looking at some of these issues at all or have any comment then.
Well, Bates, you should do much. So just briefly, I think Bates makes that case very well, and one important difference is that China now has the capacity, has the people, and, for those of us who have been in the administration over the past 5 years, you can see that in the six-party talks and the non-proliferation dialogue. They have the people to implement this strategy. The thing that struck me reading the book is that the roots in Deng Xiaoping's four modernizations and the course he set, and in some ways the unanswered questions from Deng's revolution remain unanswered, the what for part. It's still largely about domestic issues, and that comes out quite clearly and quite convincingly in the book.
My observation certainly wouldn't be a scholarly one in terms of its roots, but it is interesting to see on the other opposite end of the spectrum in terms of its kind of trickle down, and that is just to have witnessed from the Washington point of view the maturation process of the embassy and the levels of the Chinese Foreign Service that actually would deal with the press and others. I mean, it was like only about 3 years ago when, from an editor, they would say, well, did you get the Chinese reaction to whatever this thing was? And we would kind of laugh and say, there really is no such thing. I mean, it's not, with the time differences on, there might have been certain things you could have gotten from Beijing, but the idea that the embassy would respond to certain things with any swiftness was just out of the question. Now that's changed quite a lot, really, within the last couple of years, in part, I think, because they've gotten better in Beijing at formulating what responses to certain things would be so that if someone calls, they have it there. I don't think it's still not really the kind of fluid, spontaneous sort of thing that certainly any spokesman is speaking on behalf of the government in the way that a U.S. spokesman could. But I think some of the finer points of their diplomacy have now gotten to the point where they can sort of enunciate it. And just the whole public diplomacy side has gotten to be so much more advanced. And that's certainly clear with the interactions with the press corps, though it still can be pretty ham-handed in other ways, too. But anyway, that's one small observation.
Here's a tough question.
Basically, John Zan with CTI TV of Taiwan. This question is for Weibei's and for the two panelists. I apologize, I haven't read the book, haven't had the time to read the book, but I'm curious to know. We all know that Taiwan has long been a very important factor, if not the most important factor, in China's diplomacy or security strategy and in its relations with the United States. Have you seen, have you detected any changes in terms of China's policy or tactics towards Taiwan in the past 7 or 9 years?
Absolutely, and the book does go into a good bit of detail on this, both in terms of the challenges that China's approach to Taiwan present to us and potential opportunities. And I guess the way to summarize it is an intensification of both the carrot and the stick. And much of what I define as the new security diplomacy in terms of China's relations with its neighbors can be reflected, or is reflected, I think, in many cases with regard to its approach to Taiwan. That said, obviously, I think the relationship of China between China and Taiwan and China and Japan are the big outlying exceptions, you know, to the overall approach China is taking to its international relationships. But even so, one can make the argument that with regard to Taiwan, they, as I say, have intensified the carrots by opening up even more to potential investment, by trying to cultivate leading figures of the opposition party in Taiwan, even taking steps that one might define as being attempts to reach the hearts and minds of the Taiwan people. For example, offering school tuition, university tuition for Taiwan students at the same price as mainland Chinese students, or offering to lower the tariffs on certain imports from Taiwan, et cetera, et cetera. So there are instances, I think, of where they're trying to put forward this benign and peaceful and constructive image. That all being done, at the same time, obviously, they're intensifying the stick as well. I think under the broad rubric of China's so-called peaceful development rise, or the broad rubric of what I'm calling China's new security diplomacy, they've been able to do an enormous amount in terms of expanding their military potential vis-a-vis Taiwan. And I think much of, a part of the new security diplomacy has to be seen in that light as being an effort to try and deflect attention away from this core national security response that they've undertaken vis-a-vis Taiwan. So the short answer, John, is yes, both in terms of the carrot and in the stick, there's been a big change in China's approach to Taiwan in this period. And as I write in the book, it vastly complicates our approach to the issue as it intensifies both the challenges and the opportunities we face there.
The wine is wearing off, so stand by. Something just occurred to me I didn't like about the book. And it wasn't that there wasn't a picture of Bates, which would have been a nice addition. No, one thing, you know, reading the Taiwan section of the book, which I read carefully because I was sure there'd be a question, it's very balanced. I think it captures very nicely the dynamic that Bates just described. And maybe this is analytically not something that can be really done well, but one thing that occurred to me reading it and that I'd like to know, that I think is important to understand, is the effect of dissuasion and deterrence on Chinese behavior towards Taiwan. We can see that there's more, you know, united front strategy, there's more efforts to use carrots and so forth. To what extent is that shift? Certainly there are opportunities because of economic interdependence with Taiwan, but to what extent is that shift the result of the U.S.-Japan defense guidelines and things like that? My bias instinctively is to say that deterrence and dissuasion had an effect and had an important effect on Chinese behavior. But when we, you know, Bates very rightly points out this challenge of the defense dilemma, and as we try to calculate this defense dilemma question, we need to try to understand better, if we can, what effect deterrence, dissuasion, balancing by other countries in Asia. Australia last weekend signed with Japan a security cooperation agreement. They carefully said it's not about China, but it clearly has some implications, the balancing behavior of Vietnam and Indonesia. This kind of thing, I think, must be having an effect on Beijing's own calculation based on exactly what Bates points out, and maybe that's for the next one because that's a tough nut to crack analytically, but I think there's probably something there.
I just would point out quickly, because it's interesting, occasionally when Taiwanese delegations come through Washington, obviously not high-level ones, and I've met with some even fairly recently, what's interesting is how perilous, in some ways, maybe that's a little overstating it, Taiwan's position is in Washington, because some of it's a generational thing where I think the people that sort of remember the heyday of the true fervor about Taiwan are leaving the scene increasingly and being replaced by people who remember or know mainly the increasing dependence that we have on China. And one of them was pointing out recently, and this is sort of my interpretation of it, that if you were to run all words uttered through Congress in the various committees or on the floors of Congress through some supercomputer and determine how many times the word Taiwan was said, that it would probably be about a 20th of the time now that it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. There's just much less talk about Taiwan. And certainly the defense of Taiwan is implicit, but there's just much less concern that what we mainly talk about in terms of concerns about China are more directly towards the U.S. or, of course, economic concerns that we have. But when China owns as much of our foreign debt as they do, they have also a different sort of relationship. I just think that that is the main challenge that Taiwan faces, at least on the U.S. front, is maintaining its core relevance here.
Bates, just a question on an observation that you made before, that the change in China's security diplomacy was probably, if not inevitable, at least it was their only alternative. Oftentimes, countries, for a variety of reasons, choose what might not be considered their best alternative as their policy. So I'm wondering if you could make some observations about the possibility, and in the course of your research, if you had come across any alternative visions of China's international security policy, particularly toward the United States, that we might see in case there was some sort of a change of heart or change of leadership in China. In other words, what we've seen is a kind of linear development and the emplacement of intelligent and sensible policies by a leadership with considerable continuity over time. But I'm wondering if you were able to see alternative visions or views within the Chinese leadership or elements of the Chinese leadership that we might see in a different circumstance.
Thanks a lot, Bob. I think the best place to look for a recent potential turning point, and again, praising the work that's already been done before, well before me, by Dave Finkelstein, in interpreting some of the debates which unfolded in China over the course of the summer of 1999. This was shortly after the bombing of the Beijing embassy in Belgrade, where it appeared at the time that there could have been some turning point. I mean, it wasn't just the bombing itself which sparked this debate. There had been a debate, I think, building, especially beginning with the end of the Cold War and the sort of emergence of the United States as a dominant hegemon, contrary to the expectations of many Chinese strategists at the time, who had either hoped for or expected that the post-Cold War world would result in a more multipolar and equitable distribution of international power. That the fact that it didn't was already generating a good bit of concern in Chinese strategic circles. Actions specifically taken by the United States over the course of the mid to late 1990s for these interpreters of the international scene were accelerating and moving in a direction which were increasingly contrary to Chinese expectations and interests, and that the Belgrade bombing, in a sense, sort of crystallized in a tragic and singular moment all of these bugaboos and concerns of this element of Chinese strategic thinking, and that this then catalyzed an important discussion in China about what China's response needed to be in this what was being seen by some as an increasingly threatening international situation. So I think there are surely still today, while those elements that argued for a more confrontational approach to the United States, or who would have argued forcefully to seek partnerships internationally that would, you know, turn out to be in a kind of concerted effort to counterbalance very actively American power, those voices lost out. But I think those voices are probably still around. It would make sense to me, especially in China today, as it seems there is greater and greater opportunity for people to take views quite contrary to the mainstream, that there would be voices that are still arguing for the need to be tougher, if you will, or recognize earlier on the need to counterbalance American force. I think there might be a good argument to be made that, for example, those in the PLA who wanted to see the ASAT test go forward in January probably had this as one of their major arguments, that there's a serious need to try and demonstrate to the United States that that the U.S. isn't always going to get their way necessarily simply on the basis of technological and military superiority. So I think there are voices like that, Bob. I don't think that they're necessary. I don't think they're in the mainstream right now, but I think they're there and aren't going to go away easily. I mean, China does face a very, very difficult strategic environment over the longer term. That is, to achieve the aspirations that the country would like and to sort of find itself as an equal or even better in the world table with regard to the United States. But to get there is going to, you know, have to involve, you know, either conflict or serious confrontation with the United States, potentially. And that, I don't think, is a path that anyone right now in China is really, really prepared to undertake. The big question, as Mike raises, is, well, what about 20 years from now? Maybe things will be very different, and I try to make that case here, that is a very serious, challenging aspect of the new security diplomacy, that if anything, China is going to be in a better and better position if it chooses down the road to move towards that direction that's more confrontational with the U.S. Jacob, and then we'll go here. A lot of questions still. We got. Go ahead, Jacob, and then sir, and then.
Thank you, Beth. This is my name is Jacob Chen from KMT PAP office. I really want to commend Beth's efforts in writing this book. I have one short comment and one question. The short comment is just last week, Admiral Fallon testified in the House Armed Service Committee. He said that the tension in Taiwan Strait is much lower than 2 years ago, which probably proves your view that China's use of sticks and carrots really did work. My question is, in 2 weeks ago, in another think tank across the street with another author written a book about China, they didn't offer wine and cheese, but they did offer a sandwich afterwards. The author has three scenarios for the future of China. First one is a soothing scenario that China will become democratic after it becomes economically prosperous. Second one is upheaval scenario that China will collapse, which the author did not identify with. The third one is the third scenario, which is China will be like this, a dictatorship for a long, long time. What's your take on China's future? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jacob. Why don't I just take a couple? I will definitely respond to that. I just want to get a couple other issues on the table, if I could. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Bates. I was going to follow up on the ASAT question.
Mm-hmm.
Who authorized it? Was this a pseudo-independent activity of PLA, or was this something that the cabinet discussed, approved, but the foreign ministry didn't seem to know much about or be able to respond to? Or obviously something in between.
Thanks. And let me get Ernie's question, and then we'll try to respond to some of these things.
Ernie Preig, Manufacturers Alliance, also now visiting fellow at CSIS. And my question is about India. As you know, I'm engaged in study. I've just been out there. And the question is, in the overall, a lot of economic build up with China, but there's also an important security dimension. And my question is, where is it going from the China point of view? Dates back to the 62 war, which is still, you know, China routed the Indian army, destroyed Nehru and the Chow relationship. The Pakistan relationship and China's assistance to the nuclear development in Pakistan is a big issue. More recently, it's the military buildup in China, particularly the Navy, the Blue Water Fleet, Bay of Bengal, Malacca Strait. There's a Myanmar connection there as well. And my only other comment is both sides say it's a very positive relation and everything. My experience recently in India for a few weeks is that's what the Indians say publicly, but when you talk to them privately, it's quite different as India drifts much closer to the U.S. and to some extent related to China.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, what's really going on within China in terms of their strategic directions vis-a-vis India?
Well, those are all huge questions. I hope my colleagues will join in, especially since the Chinese did consult you on the ASAP thing, didn't they, Mike? Okay.
And I did authorize it.
Okay, good. Just a quick comment. The question was raised concerning the recent book by Jim Mann called China Fantasy, and Jim makes an interesting case about the fact that maybe our long-term bet with China is wrong, that engagement will not lead necessarily to a more open, equitable, fair China in the future. You know, this isn't the place to probably to be debating Jim Mann's book. One of my responses would be that Jim's main point, while interesting and very eloquently delivered because he's such a good journalist, is not a particularly new idea. It's been debated for a long, long time amongst China scholars, and I think probably 5 years ago, if not before, the consensus has been reached among most mainstream China watchers that we're going to have the Chinese Communist Party to live with for a good deal longer. So it's an interesting book. It's going to be, I suspect, getting some traction here because he presents the ideas in very crisp and eloquent ways. But I would only argue that his argument that this is something that people aren't paying attention to really isn't accurate. The ASAT, I don't know the answer to the question. I don't think anybody does. Maybe some people do, but they're not telling. My personal take is I find compelling the argument just based on previous somewhat similar examples of PLA operations. I find it compelling that it's quite possible that a test like this was undertaken without the knowledge or serious consultation with people, and let me emphasize this next line, with which we are familiar. I think that's quite possible. When you consider that the Chinese foreign minister probably doesn't even rank in the top 30 people in China making important decisions, that says a lot. So, yes, I think that's an interesting explanation. It makes some sense to me. The more important issue for me is, what does that tell us about our future relationship with China? What does it tell us about who we ought to be talking to? What does it tell us about the kinds of relationships we need to be establishing well beyond and above our sort of usual suspects? On the China-India question, I'm not a real expert on this. I do get into the China-India relationship a little bit in this book. I try to make the argument that there's a lot more there than we may realize. It seems to be a little contrary to the takeaways you're having. But again, getting back to just what seems to make strategic sense for the two countries, I think in the near to medium term, it makes a lot more sense for both to be pursuing, you know, as constructive a relationship as they possibly can, and that attempts, if there are any, on our part in the United States to exploit differences or exaggerate those differences in ways that we think we can take advantage of are probably ill-advised. Do you want to add any points to these issues, guys?
Well, on the anti-satellite test, I think Bates captured what we don't know very well.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, good job. I was struck that my old boss, Steve Hadley, in a press conference suggested that our government thought basically what Bates said, which is that knowledge of this ASAT test was not necessarily, as Bates said, shared with the people with whom we deal. It is, from my perspective, a disturbing recurrence of what we saw in the EP3. Mm-hmm. In the case of the EP3, we didn't have connectivity to talk about this, and the information about the incident that the Chinese leadership was receiving as it dealt with the president and others was incomplete. We had better information, frankly. So the information flow within China is a problem. Then with the submarine incursion into Japanese EEZ, similar problem. It doesn't seem to be getting better. I think that transparency is important in this context, not because Beijing will necessarily be transparent in the way we think of it, but because it's useful to put some pressure on senior Chinese leaders to be accountable for what the PLA does and to be armed with information to talk about it with President Bush or Secretary Rice or Bob Gates. I mean, I think what we're doing is playing a two-level game here where we're trying to empower those in China who with whom we deal who should have this information and some influence in the decision-making about when these things happen. And I was in India last month, spent considerable time there and more time here and in Tokyo talking to the Indians about Asia. And I think you've captured it exactly. India also has a kind of peaceful development strategy which requires, you know, stability around its periphery, including with China, but beneath the surface, I hear the same thing that you hear. Interestingly, in my own, I'm not as intensely engaged as Bates, but in my own interactions with Chinese counterparts, both when I was in the NSC and now at CSIS, I hear from Chinese friends, I don't know if you do, Bates, the assessment you just gave, which is that India is sort of drifting in our direction, and that's sort of part of the teleology they see from Beijing.
Thanks, Mike. I want to try to wrap this up by around 6:30, if I could, so these guys can get home to where they need to be, and so we can have some glass of wine together, but are there a couple of other questions we could bring to the fore here, and then we'll wrap up? Ah, the wine is calling to everyone. Please, you've been very patient, sir.
Okay, I'll be very quick. Wang Liang from George Washington University. Just first, congratulations on the book. I think not only Georgetown students, David Shambaugh students, GW, including myself, will read this book as well. You mentioned the Chinese, the TIFA, the authoritative statements a couple of times in your book as well as in your presentation. I think there's interesting involvement of Chinese TIFA in terms of, on the one hand, we see Chinese people leadership talking about China's peaceful rise, while like a year later, it changed to peaceful development. Mm. So to me, this involvement is more like two steps forward, one step back. So I want to see your perception or your research about the involvement of China's self-positioning or self-perception in the international system against a backdrop of China's rise, and also how does China's self-positioning plays into China's rise. Thank you.
Hmm. Wow, that's a question for Professor Shambaugh, I think, to answer. But I guess the important sort of soundbite or bumper sticker takeaway that I found in looking at all these TIFA and the eagerness with which they are put forward is that beneath it all, there is a recognition that I think is important on the part of the Chinese leadership and the part of its strategists, and that is, as I mentioned, the recognition of the security dilemma. Because prior to this very public expression of the peaceful development rise and responsible great power and all of that, there tended to be, from the early to mid to even late 1990s, my interpretation, a sense that China could rise and it would be peaceful just because we're peaceful, and that there didn't seem to be any need to dig even more deeply into that kind of a statement and understand that by its very rise, it is disruptive, like it or not, and that that's just the nature of international relations. The interesting turning point, though, I think, was the recognition of that fact and the redoubled effort then to at least try to explain how this rise was, in fact, not going to be similar to other instances in international relations history that did prove disruptive. Now, we can argue about whether their debate is right. We can argue about whether they've done enough hard work in reassuring neighbors about this, about their intentions. I think we have serious arguments to make on those questions. But I take it as a good sign that they're prepared to engage the debate and at least try to come up with explanations and begin to build the frameworks of thinking internally for it to be so. That's a good sign, and we ought to be thankful for it. Most recently, we now see Hu Jintao's attempt to make his contribution to the pay-in of Chinese international relations, TIFA, and that's this notion of building a harmonious world, which I don't get into the book because it was just, publication deadlines and whatnot. But I don't think in substance it's all that different from what Deng Xiaoping and Jiang Zemin were trying to say. It strikes me Jiang Zemin had a sharper way of conceptualizing it and expressing it and putting it forward. We haven't heard that yet as strongly and crisply yet, I don't think, from Hu Jintao, but it's basically the same, I think, overall thrust. It's the recognition that for China's success and for its strategic development, it has to try to realize a relatively stable and mutually beneficial set of relationships with all of its key partners. And I would include Japan and Taiwan in that list. And I said generally stable, generally positive, generally constructive, but that's the overall trend. So I take that all as a good sign. And our job now is to do even better in taking advantage of this approach and trying to even further deepen China's commitment to it. Not that we'll succeed, but we have little other choice but to try.
I just think we should try to inaugurate the tradition in the United States where we also distill our foreign policy down to two words. I think that's a pretty useful thing. I actually had a kind of funny moment. I was traveling. Rising Star, that's us. I was traveling, I guess it was 2 years ago, with Ambassador Joe. I went on a trip when he was out in Iowa, and it was about 3 weeks after Zelig's speech where he talked about responsible stakeholder, and of course that provoked a big debate in China about what those two words meant. And so I said to Ambassador Joe, it's like there's so much debate within the administration and so many different views about China, depending on whether you're at the Pentagon or the State Department. So what is the core view of China within the Bush administration? He said, we're a responsible stakeholder. So that had become, at least for that moment, the two-word description.
We're done. Okay. Well, listen, why don't we take a little break here, and I would, again, want to thank all of you very much for your kind interest, for your excellent questions. Please do keep those questions and criticism coming in, and thank you for everything you've done to help me complete this book, and I look forward to continuing our work together. Thanks to both of our commentators as well.